Brad Johnson, thanks for joining us at Montana Public Radio.
Good to be here, Eric. Thank you.
Why do you want to be the next governor of Montana?
Well, if folks look at my record, they'll see that for the last nearly decade and a half, I've had a very real commitment to serving the people of Montana, having had the privilege to serve as Secretary of State for 4 years and now as Chairman of the Montana Public Service Commission. And as I've spent the last 9 months or so on the commission, a couple of things became really clear to me. One, I think our legislative process in some important areas is broken. I was very frustrated with the legislative session this time, particularly the budget process, where we looked at a $10 billion budget that the Finance and Claims Committee in the Senate heard in 2 days. 2 days, $10 billion, that's not a good equation. And then at executive action, there were literally file folders full of budget amendments that were passed en masse. And that was very problematic to me as head of part of the executive branch of government. That approach to the budget certainly impacted us in a way that I think was less than positive. And then beyond that, it has become awfully evident to me that the federal government's intrusion and overreach into policy areas that have been traditionally the purview of the states is just out of control. So many of the decisions that the Public Service Commission has to make now have been basically dictated by federal policy, and it all came together. And I looked at that and said, you know, if we're going to preserve some kind of traditional relationship between the states and the federal government, the kind of relationship that the framers of the Constitution envisioned, we're going to have to start pushing back at the state level. It's too late for us to expect the federal government to fix itself. It is, like I said, out of control. So how
does as governor of Montana, how do you do something about federal government involvement in Montana?
Well, you look at things, for example, like the Clean Power Plan that's currently on the table that is going to be just disastrous for us economically. And you start with engaging, for example, the Attorney General's office and other regulators in this case, and where I'm at now, visiting with other regulators in Western states that have been impacted similarly by the plan. And you say, look, we've got to come together and create a united front. We've got to look at where we can conceivably litigate effectively against this. We've got to see if we can't rally the political forces and push back. You know, Montana, standing alone in a battle over federal policy is at a tremendous disadvantage. We have three members of the Congress, two senators and a member of the House of Representatives. There are 535 votes being cast up there every time there's a vote. So we've got to try and build some strength in numbers and, like I say, when we can litigate effectively. When we went through the process of commenting on the draft rule for the Clean Power Plan, the EPA just dismissed out of hand all of the input that Montana made from the governor's office, from the PSC, and from the legislature, and came back with this, and I'm not big on hyperbole, but it really is a draconian plan for Montana. And are we going to win all these fights, Eric? Probably not. There are going to be some real tough ones out there. But there are a couple of things that I point out when people raise the fact that it's going to be a tough slog. One, if we don't try, we know what the outcome is going to be. And secondly, I think when you look at the history of Montana and you look at the history of this country, it's not been our way to back off from a tough fight. If we'd looked at the probable outcome of a little skirmish that started in 1776 and said, boy, it's going to be awful tough to win that, and based our decision on that assessment of the situation, we'd all still be subjects of the crown.
Well, what you described there in your example about the Clean Power Plan and rallying other elected officials to unite to fight Montana's case, that sounds like it's a leadership challenge, and certainly the governor is a leadership position. So tell me more about your background and what experience do you have that would give voters confidence that you'd be a good leader for the state of Montana?
Well, as Secretary of State, I was the lone statewide elected Republican in Montana for 4 years, and yet we were able to pushed through the legislature some very important election-related law, not the least of which was a bill that requires Montana to tabulate votes from paper ballots. That has, instead of using electronic voting machines, that has been a tremendously beneficial law for us as we've had some difficult recount situations over time and the like. That was something that was very much an initiative on my part. I think you look at the fact that I'm the first, to the best of my knowledge, the first freshman member of the Public Service Commission to move into the role of chairman. That means a great deal to me that fellow commissioners had that level of faith in me. And, you know, just looking at my bio, if you will. You know, I was on student council in high school. I was the ag school's representative on the courses and curriculum committee at the University of Illinois. Been chairman of countless committees and groups over time with Chambers of Commerce and Downtown Bozeman Association and that kind of thing. So trying to rally the troops and provide some leadership has just been part of my life over time.
You talked about your experience working on elections issues, and I wonder what your feelings are about the campaign finance law that the Montana legislature passed this last legislative session.
Well, the devil's going to end up being in the details, and I'm withholding comment on the Commissioner Modell's rules until the final draft is out there and really dissected. But I will tell you conceptually, I believe that sunshine is absolutely the best disinfectant. I think that
and this finance law is basically just says that if you're going to spend money to influence elections, you have to report where that money's coming.
We as voters get to know where it comes from. Like I say, conceptually, I was very much supportive of the bill and still am very supportive of the concept. We need to make sure we get the rules implemented correctly. The campaign finance situation in Montana today overall is a mess. We have created such a complex set of rules and regulations that more often than not, what we're doing in instance after instance is inadvertently turning candidates and politicians into crooks. Not because they were trying to do something to skirt the law, but because the law is so doggone complex. And as governor, one of the things that I would try and do would be to have a comprehensive reform effort for the campaign laws in the state. It's laudatory that we address the dark money issue, and I think that was really up front. But there's much more in addition to that that we need to do.
The Montana law was in many ways a response to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case, and that was the case where the court said it was okay for corporations and unions to spend unlimited amounts of money on activities to influence elections. Do you think that was the right call?
It's probably not the call I would have made. I would prefer to see a world where individuals were the source of financing political campaigns, that, you know, the idea of elections theoretically and ideally being of, by, and for the people, I think, is a very positive one. And I hope we can move in that direction where we start to limit the impact of big outside money. We're never going to get money out of politics. My gosh, Eric, you know, I think I've shown myself to be pretty effective in retail politics in Montana, and that's one of the things I like about Montana is you can still get out and meet enough people in an election to really make a difference in the outcome. But even getting in that pickup truck and heading down the road isn't cheap. In this, assuming there's a contested primary for governor here on the Republican side, we'll spend tens of thousands of dollars simply traveling the state, and we're not even getting into media budgets and that kind of thing yet.
And you know, you said assuming there is a contested primary at this point, the most high profile other candidate for governor is Bozeman businessman Greg Gianforte, who hasn't totally committed to running. He said he's exploring. assuming he's your opponent, he seems like he'd be able to self-finance. Just in terms of a campaign war chest, he seems like a pretty formidable opponent. Why should Republican primary voters choose you instead of Greg Gianforte to be the nominee for governor?
Well, I think it's important for Republican primary voters to remember that we're talking about not only picking a message, but a messenger. And Greg is a complete unknown in the political arena. Never been involved in public service, never been involved in a major campaign or an election. On the other hand, have served 4 years as Secretary of State, 4 years on the State Land Board, currently sit as Chairman of the Public Service Commission. If you look at my track record on the electoral side of things, I won a very, very tough statewide election in 2004 when I beat County Commissioner Bill Kennedy out of Billings to win the Secretary of State's race. I was elected by nearly 63% of the vote in the PSC district that I represent, and that's a district that's very much a microcosm of the state. You have a Republican stronghold in Flathead County, you have a Democratic stronghold in Lewis and Clark County, reservation county in Glacier County, kind of a swing county in Lake County, and a couple of very rural ag counties in Teton and Ponderay.
Do you think you were able to win that campaign by appealing to crossover voters or getting independents?
I was running against a four-term Democratic member of the House of Representatives from Lewis and Clark County, and I beat him in Lewis and Clark County by 0.5%. Now, that's not a big margin, but the fact that I was able, as the Republican candidate, to beat that kind of well-known Democrat in Lewis and Clark County speaks directly to that, yes.
What do you think your appeal to non-Republican voters is?
Well, Montana voters are notoriously independent when it comes to statewide elections. And I think the fact that my time in Montana since 1980, moved here from Amarillo, Texas in 1980 to work for the American Simmental Association, a beef cattle breed registry in Bozeman, I have deep roots in the ag community, very important in Montana. Agriculture still is the single most important component of our agriculture. I have been a small businessman in Montana. I started, operated, and then sold Four Corners bumper-to-bumper auto parts in Bozeman. I truly have, as they say, signed both sides of the check and done it from the perspective where I've seen the hoops and the challenges and the barriers that exist in terms of doing business in Montana, and had to deal with those directly. Montanans over the course of my political career have voted for me a million times. They know me, and an awful lot of them like me. Those are all known commodities, and there's not another candidate on the horizon on the Republican side that can bring that to the table.
Lots of different kinds of Republicans out there. In the last legislative session, we saw a number of Republican lawmakers who chose to vote with Democrats on some pretty high-profile bills. We saw other Republican state lawmakers who very much opposed that idea of compromising with the Democrats. What kind of Republican are you?
I have said ever since my college days that I am a Goldwater Reagan conservative. I'm very committed to those fundamental conservative principles of smaller government and lower taxes and greater opportunity for folks that I think result from some of those policies. Having said that, I guess I'd point out a couple of things. One, I'm also a big believer that we exist in a political system that says there are times when you've got to realize that 75 or 80% of something is a whole lot better than holding out for 100% of nothing. And I subscribe to that. I think it's vitally important that a candidate or an elected official know what his or her political core is, what those fundamental principles are, the line across which they will not compromise. But until you get to that line, good faith compromise and good faith negotiation is and should be part of the process. And the other thing I tell my Republican friends is that there's only one politician in the entire country that I agree with 100% of the time, and he's talking to you now. We're going to have differences.
Another issue that split some Republicans in the state legislature was the Flathead Water Compact, which the legislature passed, the governor signed. Do you think that was the right call?
I didn't take a position on that at the time, and have not now. I think now the proof will be in the pudding, as they say. I think there are legitimate concerns raised by those who opposed the compact, and yet there were very legitimate points made by those who supported it. And what I think we saw at the time was a dialogue that was pretty much polarized to a best case and a worst case scenario. Well, it's assuming that Congress goes forward to ratify it, it's the law of the land. So the challenge now, and the challenge that will in all likelihood involve my office if I'm privileged to be the governor, is to be proactive in heading off those potential problems while at the same time maintaining the integrity of the compact. So it's going to be one of those 75% of something issues. I think realistically to think that the compact is going to be tossed out is just not I think we're wasting time, energy, and resources if we spend much time trying to go down that road. The speed with which those challenges, I think, are going to be dispatched by the court will be stunning. I think it's going to now be, it's going to take a skilled leader negotiator to make all that work.
The recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that affirmed the right of same-sex marriage, what do you think the impact of that's going to be on Montana?
You know, once the dust settles, I don't think it's going to be dramatic. I really don't. I personally believe that that is an issue that could have and should have been left to the states. That's part of that federal overreach that I'm talking about. You know, one of the really great things about this country over our history has been its diversity, and I'm not talking about skin color there specifically, but rather that Montana isn't New Jersey, and New Jersey isn't Texas, and Texas isn't Hawaii, you know, and we have enjoyed over most of our history that wonderful diversity of culture, and I think there is a tendency on the part of some elements in Washington to want to paint that whole cultural landscape with a kind of a dreary sameness and make all 50 states the same. And I think we lose a tremendous amount of vitality if we go down that road.
You agree with the Supreme Court's decision on that issue?
No, I don't. I think that marriage has been and should remain between a man and a woman. Having said that, I've also been outspoken in support of the right for any couple to enter into a contractual arrangement that will address effectively many of the concerns that were raised by the gay community with regard to formalizing the marriage, if you will. So there are two different roads there in my view. But no, a marriage in the traditional sense, in the sense that I have entered into it with my wife, is an institution, has been and should be between a man and a woman.
A lot of times voters make their decision, particularly in governor's races, based on the economic well-being of the state of Montana. It seems like in the last few years, things have gotten better. The economy seems fairly healthy in Montana. There's a budget surplus. Unemployment is below the national rate. You're smiling and almost laughing as I describe that. It's not how it looks to you.
Well, it isn't. Statistics can be awfully misleading. Yes, we have a 4.1% unemployment rate, and that's great. But when you put that in context of Montana today being 49th out of 50 states in per capita income, when in the late 60s and early 70s we were 10th in per capita income. When you look at it, a tremendous number of those 95.9% of folks that are employed being underemployed in terms of earning potential or working more than one job in order to make ends meet, we apparently have decided, I guess, in some quarters that being 49th out of 50 states in terms of that fundamental measure of prosperity is okay. I don't think it is.
So what's your plan to create better paying jobs in Montana?
Well, it's not rocket science. You look at history, you look at the fact that while all of us have come to embrace being known as Big Sky Country, and that's a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling, officially, formally, and in fact, we are still the Treasure State. I am convinced beyond question that our decline economically, that loss of prosperity that we have experienced in this state, is tied directly to the decline of our traditional resource industries and agriculture in this state. I looked, going back to my time on the land board, where national state forest was realizing something. It changed some from year to year, but on average, we were probably looking at netting, and this was a real net figure, of about $8 an acre on the 5.2 million acres that the land board managed. At the same time, the National Forest Service was losing something on the order of $1.65 an acre, almost a $10 spread in terms of the efficacy of management of those two very similar land resources. We can and should be pushing to enter into agreements with the National Forest Service and with the Bureau of Land Management to transfer meaningful administrative authority over specific tracts of that federal land to the land managers of Montana who have proven themselves to be so very capable, and we can do that in a way that fits with our existing management programs for the state lands. That's a place to start. Our rural communities in Montana, the eastern part of the state, they have been subject for decades now of just what I call benign neglect. And what we see as you travel eastern Montana is once thriving communities literally struggling to survive. We need to have a concerted effort to try and create new opportunities. In those communities, I think we can do things like create rural enterprise zones that hopefully will attract new employers to those communities. I think that we are missing a tremendous opportunity by not working very, very hard to make Montana the mecca of research and development in the clean coal technology area. We've got, in round figures, $1 billion sitting in a coal trust tax fund that we keep arguing about what should we do with that rainy day fund. I think we ought to explore taking, this is an arbitrary number now, we'd have to push a little sharper pencil, but let's say a quarter of that, $250 million, create a revolving venture capital fund to attract and to assist credible R&D projects for clean coal. If we can identify and bring into the mainstream some clean coal technology projects, could provide a tremendous boon to parts of eastern Montana. And I think from a political and policy standpoint, to say that we are simply going to out of hand dismiss coal from our energy portfolio as a state and as a nation, to say we're going to simply dismiss it as an important part of our economic structure, those are terrible policy decisions. We simply can't afford to do that. So those are a couple of areas, and obviously it's a complex issue, and there's going to be a lot more things we'll talk about, but there's some starting points.
Do you think Montana has a role to play in combating climate change, or are you even there are some people that don't believe in human-caused climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, based on the direction we're heading today, I will be honest with you, it doesn't make any difference whether or not climate change is man-caused, because what we're doing today, and this is part of what makes the whole clean power plan approach on the part of the administration so pointless. If we implement 111D, the clean power plan, as it is today, by 2030, and these are estimates that we've cranked out in our office at PSC with our analysts who are professionals, and I put a tremendous amount of, they're not political appointees or anything else. They have no agenda here. Their estimate is that if we did everything that we talked about in the Clean Power Plan nationally, by 2030, the differential in global CO2 levels will be 1.38%. We will not have made a dent in what is the perceived problem. So we will have incurred tremendous economic impact, cultural impact in places like eastern Montana, and not done anything to address the problem, if in fact that is the problem.
So I hear you that you're very much not liking the Clean Power Plan. In your eyes, if Montana just continued business as usual in terms of mining and burning coal at the rate we're doing now, that'd be fine with you?
It would have no statistically important impact on CO2 levels in 2030, and that's the end point that's written into the Clean Power Plan. So we'll use that as the benchmark. Our agreement in principle with the Chinese appears to be you all, between now and 2030, can do essentially anything you want with your coal consumption and your power plants and the like, and then we'll look at capping you at whatever level you've moved to in 2030. In the meantime, we're going to be undertaking all of these Herculean efforts to reduce our emissions by 32%. And at the end of the day, it will have accomplished virtually nothing globally. And when I say that, I'm then told by proponents of the Clean Power Plan, yes, but we've got to set the right example in terms of our behavior. And that is a wonderful concept. The problem is it's not very realistic. My colleague on the commission just got back from a trip to China where they were meeting with Chinese officials on their whole clean coal effort and the like. And he indicated to me that when the Chinese are talking about reducing emissions from coal, their focus still is on particulates like ours was 30 mm-hmm. years ago. That's what they're trying to clean up so that you can go walk down a street in Beijing without having to have a respirator on.
Do you think Montana should be mining more coal or burning more coal? Do you think that would be good for the state?
Well, I don't think there's not a lot of additional intrastate new market for coal. We're not going to build huge new coal-fired plants. I think we ought to certainly have policies that allow Colstrip to live out its useful life, as has been factored in from day one. Yes, I think we need to do that. I think that especially if we can make advances in clean coal technology and address some of these additional concerns, we certainly ought to be mining more coal. But we cannot tomorrow just take coal out of the global energy portfolio. We would see unbelievably catastrophic economic impacts around the globe. If coal went away tomorrow, and we haven't done any more than we have in terms of a transition globally away from that energy source, we're going to be in a world of hurt.
Should Montana be making it easier to develop renewable sources of energy like wind and solar?
Renewables absolutely need to be a part of the overall portfolio, and I am a huge all-of-the-above portfolio supporter. But I do believe we have come to the point where the renewables and the alternatives have got to be expected to stand on their own 2 feet economically as part of that portfolio.
So Montana shouldn't be doing anything to further encourage development of renewable energy?
I didn't say that. We ought to be encouraging development of alternative energy that is going to be able to fit in the portfolio without subsidies or a federal government saying you've got to adopt this part of it, even if it doesn't necessarily fit with your portfolio. I was at a symposium in Washington State at the National Laboratory on battery storage. We're making some very real headway in terms of that technology. There appears to be now some pretty economically viable technology that would allow some meaningful battery backup for wind generation facilities up to about 20 megawatts, which is really fits well with what we've seen going on in Montana. All right, if we can put in place a battery farm along with that wind farm that provides some meaningful truing of that wind-generated supply and do it in an economically feasible basis, then we're talking about a whole different scenario in terms of the role that wind plays. Right now, when the Public Service Commission evaluates application for a new wind facility, one of the biggest problems we have is dealing with what they call integration costs. How much is it going to cost to potentially build another natural gas-fired generating plant or whatever in order to make sure that when the wind isn't blowing or when the wind is blowing at the wrong time, that guaranteed or agreed amount of electricity that's in the power purchase agreement isn't going to be absent from the grid?
One thing that governors do is look for ways to encourage all sorts of different industries and sectors. You know, governors look for policies to help out agriculture, to help out coal mining, to help out, you know, hard rock mining, things like that. As governor, is there anything that you think you could or should do to encourage renewable development?
Sure. But it's in that context I was just speaking to, finding ways, bringing to bear technology that's going to make it fit more logically into the portfolio that we have. And I will tell you, I at the press conference when I announced Wednesday, I said that I was going to create a new department in state government called the Department of Stealing Really Good Ideas from Other States.
Like higher renewable portfolio standards, and, like neighboring states have?
Well, I said really good ideas. excuse me. I think there is so much going on in terms of energy-related technology that anybody that suggests they know what the Montana or the American or the international energy portfolio is going to look like 10 years from now is not being very honest with you, because none of us know. Some of this will move so quickly and we're going to see very rapid changes. But that's not a reason to cut the legs out from under a structure that's in place now that is working and working well. I'm not saying we ignore alternatives and that we quit looking for new technology and that we don't try and move forward. I'm saying we ought to do it instead of in what I think is a pretty arbitrary, capricious, and knee-jerk way, which is really how I see the entire saga of the Clean Power Plan, the administration. You know, keep in mind the Congress, on a pretty strongly bipartisan basis a few years ago, rejected the fundamentals of the Clean Power Plan. So the elected representatives of the people said, no, we're not ready to do that. And then we did it through fiat in the rulemaking process. I'm saying we need to take a more measured approach and not jump off the cliff.
Brad Johnson, thanks for joining us at Montana Public Radio.
Hey, Eric, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thanks.
Well, we didn't have to read it too much.
No. I think that worked out really well. So thanks. So let me, I just need to sneak in here and press a couple buttons and then I'll walk.
Make sure we really have it?
Yeah. We'll make sure we don't lose it. I know we have it. Just want to make sure it's there when...